Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, it's producer Betsy here. I'm usually working behind the scenes at Offscript Media, but today I'm interrupting your regularly scheduled programming because Matt's out of the office. So we're rebroadcasting his amazing interview with John Tesh. TV anchor, investigative journalist, musician, film composer, author. From what I can tell, there isn't anything this guy doesn't do. He even played keyboards with Yanni. Yeah, you heard that right. Enjoy the show.
I mean, no one plans to get sick, and yet, here we are. My name is Matthew Zachary. I survived cancer, a stroke, and COVID-19. And somehow, I'm still here. I also survived our stupid broken healthcare system, and I want to help you survive it too. So let's go make healthcare suck less together. Because you know what? We're all out of patience. Hey, that's the name of the show. I got the chance to sit down. Well, not really sit down, but you know what I mean. And talk to one of my idols in the music industry, the one and only John Tesh. This is one of the most exciting and interesting interviews I've ever done. Among many other things, we talk about his new book, Relentless, Unleashing a Life of Purpose, Grit, and Faith. So please enjoy my conversation with the one and only John Tesh. John Tesh, welcome to Out of Patience. I'll just start by letting you know all the things we have in common that we didn't quite know we had in common. We're both pianists, composers, cancer survivors, radio show hosts. We have a connection to the late Jerry Goldsmith. We both lost and regained functions of our body to get our career back on track. You've performed at Red Rocks, and I visited Red Rocks. So I'll leave it at that.
Have you dated my wife?
Say hi to Connie for me. I'm sure she knows exactly who I am. That's awesome. I was just so thrilled you were interested in being interviewed on our show, and your new book, Relentless, Unleashing a Life of Purpose, Grit, and Faith. But we can't not start anything without discussing your music.
Well, first of all, I've always wanted to be you. Studying under Jerry Goldsmith is one of my all-time favorite composers. And I wanted my whole life to be. I mean, I used to actually shoot movies in my backyard with my cat Tippy. This is actually in the book where I was concerned about the ASPCA's reaction to this. I built a harness for the cat and used some fishing line and flew the cat, quote unquote, across my mom's clothesline. And I did all of the sound effects with my mouth of Tippy going to Mars was the name of the horror film. It sounded like this. I was the original theremin, if you will. By the time I got to Entertainment Tonight, I had really, a lot of people think that that's where my career started. And I don't blame them because, you know, when 23 million people a night see you anchoring the celebrity headlines, that's who you are. But for 15 years before that, I was working in local news. I was working in local news and also working at sports. And when I was at CBS Sports was when music combined with media. But when I was a kid, it really wasn't. Music for me was just a way to get noticed. I think it is for a lot of boys too. But when I was in junior high school, I was 6'6" in junior high. I'm 6'6" now. I weigh 225 pounds right now. But in junior high, I weighed 152. There were no hormones yet at all, and so I sounded like this.
Very young piece of you right there.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, it's a giant rabbit. anyway, my mom had strapped me to a piano, basically, because that's just what she was, a taskmaster. And so I learned classical piano as a kid, and a lot of Stravinsky, mostly Rachmaninoff pieces. And then I realized when the Dave Clark 5 came along that you could actually play a keyboard in a band. And I bought myself with lawn mowing money, a Magnus chord organ. And so I was in a rock band. Yes.
Wait, so you did it for the girls, right?
Yeah. And we were in a rival band. My band was called, we had two bands, The Days of Night and also the Best of Both Worlds. I was also, I had a great teacher when we were seven, all of us in Stewart Avenue Elementary School. He just handed out instruments and you had to play an instrument. Otherwise, you know, you had to be in the choir, and I didn't want to be in the choir. So it was always, I was surrounded by so much music that I was convinced that I was going to go on, you know, and go to music school. And I had been named twice to the New York State Symphonic Orchestra as a baritone horn player. But my parents, especially my dad, decided that that wasn't going to be my future.
You know, I have fond memories of Sam Goody in the Staten Island Mall.
Oh.
And it was basically a fee for service. If I knew that the girl I liked wanted me to learn Lionel Richie or Billy Joel or whatever, I'd go to Sam Goody and buy the song they wanted to hear. It's exactly the same story.
Yeah, it's. I mean, there were two currencies at Garden City High School on Long Island back in the day, and one was playing in a rock band, and the other was a letter jacket. And the funny thing is that I had a letter jacket in three sports, three varsity sports, even though I was a skinny mini, and I was in two rock bands that played at all the school, you know, dances and played, you know, in auditoriums and stuff. I couldn't get any girls because I was just so hideously skinny. So none of that, the skinniness, it canceled all that stuff out.
Do you feel like your own inadequacies were what drove you to want to prove yourself to get the girls?
Oh yeah. I mean, the inadequacies and plutonium was added. My dad would not do well parenting a millennium, and so, you know, it wasn't music really. I mean, he paid for the piano lessons, and he would wake me up at, like, you know, as like a 7-8-year-old. I can still remember it. He'd wake me up at 11:30 at night. They'd be partying. My parents were big entertainers, and he dragged me down, and I'd have to play, you know, at least as much as I could remember of Rachmaninoff's Prelude in C sharp minor. And
the shooting at the feet in the Westerns. Play.
Exactly. Is exactly what that was. And they tried to get me, my mom tried to get me to learn the accordion. And I remember saying to her, I said, I'm not playing anything you have to strap to you.
Insert any Benny Hill theme you want after
exactly,
that.
Yeah, right. Perfect.
Exactly. You know, I came home one day in sixth grade. My mom played when she was a kid, and my grandma threw her piano out when she got married. Because that's what apparently old Jewish.
How do you throw a piano out?
We came back from the honeymoon, and like two things were missing: my dad's baseball cards and my mom's piano, which is gone.
Gosh.
They moved into this apartment after their honeymoon, so my mom never really got to play. She was a kindergarten teacher in the 80s, and there was a piano in the classroom, so she just kind of started picking it up. And then one day, my dad's like, "I'm going to buy you a little spinet as a gift for the house." And I showed up one day at home after sixth grade, and there's a piano in the house.
Wow!
And I was like, "All right, where do you put your fingers?" And my mom just showed me some Annie Get Your Gun song or whatever. And I just took to it. She's like, "You're getting lessons. I don't care. You're starting here." One of the girls that I knew I'd want to play piano for to impress was already getting lessons from this really strict Juilliard graduate. I had this like 180 culture flip into, you're only learning classical music. And unlike you, I have sausage fingers and I can't play Rachmaninoff, and I couldn't stretch the 11 keys for Rhapsody in Blue. But I did my best with the sonatas and sonatinas. Then I found Sam Goody and the girls, and I never told my piano teacher, Bertha Mandel, that I was cheating on her with pop music.
That's an amazing story.
So did you own a Moog? I want to ask you, did you own a Moog?
Yeah, I did. I was a huge, this didn't happen until I got into college, but I was, in fact, the odd thing is that I'm actually friends with this guy. I don't even know how that happened, but I was a big Rick Wakeman fan. But Rick Wakeman is the keyboard player for Yes. He was my favorite multi-keyboardist. And so I had to try and get every keyboard that he had. And so when I was in New York, I had a mini Moog and what was known as a multi Moog.
I guess the real measure of a man is how many keyboards did you stack vertically to be a successful musician?
Yeah. I mean, it's like a letter jacket. Like, you know, how many of the things did you have stitched on? You could do that with keyboards.
I remember watching Yanni at the Acropolis, and he was like surrounded by I don't know how you remember what is what. And then when I got to Binghamton, I went to school there to study music and theater, and they had a MIDI room that looked like, you know, you could sit in the middle like a drum set and just play like 40 keyboards at the same time. And it's like the ultimate like multimedia, multisensory experience.
Yeah, I mean, I know Yanni for years. In fact, we actually toured together for 6 or 7 shows, and I know a lot about Yanni. What people don't realize about, just to digress for a second, people don't realize about Yanni is that, you know, his image with the flowing black hair and
the mustache
and his finger up in the air, you know, and sort of directing everybody, and you know, and with that smile. What people don't realize, because that's such a big image, is that he's a tremendous keyboard player. And writer. I mean, if you really want the original Yanni, it was written in his basement in Minneapolis. It's called Keys to Imagination, and he really out Vangelis's Vangelis.
I mean, Song for Antarctica is one of my staples that I just researched endlessly when I was writing my works in college. I had this vision to be on like the Narada Equinox label. And that was just like one of these aspirations I wanted to have. I never really wrote original piano music until I got sick. But I was writing, you know, I mean, again, our common thread with Jerry Goldsmith. I had this aspiration, James Horner, you know, James Newton Howard is a huge composer hero of mine. You know, all these influences out there. And it's funny because now with this crazy COVID crap going on, everyone's rewatching the movie Outbreak with Dustin Hoffman. And that is one of the best soundtracks that Jimmy ever wrote.
I scored like 3 films, and I did a cartoon show with Howie Mandel for 5 years called Bobby's World.
Yes.
But it didn't take long to dawn on me as I was in Los Angeles. There were people that were, including you, they were far better than me. It is a, you know, people watch films like, oh, I really like that music. I tried to get a record deal with anybody, you know, in the days of Entertainment Tonight. I started in 1986, and prior to that, I had written literally hundreds of hours of music for sporting events and themes, including the NBA basketball theme. And so I just thought, well, listen, here I am at Entertainment. The reason I took the Entertainment Tonight job was because it was only 4 hours a day in Los Angeles, and I was coming from New York, and I also realized that this is where they made movies, you know, and this is where they made television shows. Maybe I could do something musically. And so I had all this music from the Tour de France and from all of these other big sporting events that I had written. And I basically applied to be signed to any record label, including A&M and Columbia and Arista. And actually had a conversation with Quincy Jones about this, you know, a couple of years ago. You know, it was very funny. And I got turned down by everybody and realized that my only way in was to do what I watched Yanni do at Red Rocks. And I went to my wife and said, the only way for me to be taken seriously as a musician is for me to do something huge. She agreed, and we went to PBS, and PBS said, no thank you. It basically, if you want to chart my whole life, I'm very used to no thank you.
I know. It's the best motivator, though.
It can be. It can be. For some people, it can be an excuse.
So how did you get greenlit for Red Rocks?
It's a very interesting chapter in the book, actually. Ken Cragen, who now is a friend of mine, I'm very good at cold calling people, especially cancer doctors. I'll just call them right off and say, hey. So anyway, Ken Cragen did We Are the World. He put that together, which was, you know, as you remember, that was massive. And also Hands Across America. Then he wrote a book called Life is a Contact Sport. I'm on vacation. I pick up that book because I love reading books about decoding greatness. I always have. And I read this book, and it was about how he put that together. And his big treatise was that you need to do something big and then following it and just keep following it up by supporting it and staying in that lane, so to speak, you know. And so I read that. And then the same month, I saw these guys, PBS had just started doing things like, I really think the big start for them with music was the three tenors. And then they followed up with Yanni. And I knew the data on these guys. I knew what kind of, because I was, you know, still trying to sell records at QVC.
That was a phenomenon.
I mean, it was, talk about an overnight success, right? I mean, these guys worked their whole lives to do what they do, and same with Yanni. But all of a sudden, Yanni went from selling, you know, 100 records a week to what, gold records all over the place. And so,
yeah.
I realized that my path was not going to be a record company. I needed to start my own record company. And listen, I cheated. I mean, I had television money, right? So, you know, my wife was a famous actress. I was on ET making 7 figures, and we'd been saving money. So I went to PBS and pitched it. They said, no, you don't have a history. And they said, if you make the special, then we'll take a look at it.
Oh, God.
Yeah, right. And they still do it that to this day because they can, right? Because when they air a special, it's not like NBC where it airs once, right, as a special. PBS is an infomercial. So they, you know, not only do they play the whole special over and over and over again for 3 years, that was Red Rocks, but they also, in between it, they're doing these pledge drives, as you know, and they're holding up the album and they're talking about your tour and all the rest of that. So that was, to me, that was my future. And so long story short, it's too late for that right now.
Yeah.
Long story longer. I went to Connie and we figured out what it was going to cost. We figured it was going to be we have to take a second mortgage on our house. And we did. And we hired the 80-piece Colorado Symphony Orchestra for a month and all of the rehearsals and 15 cameras that my friend David Michaels put together. And the budget started at $600,000 and went to $1.2 million. So we would have definitely lost everything if it hadn't worked. 4 songs in, and you can see this on the Red Rock special, but you can also you can read about it. Four songs in. It rained like it had never rained in Red Rock. 30 years it hadn't rained like that, of course, my luck. What happens to violin players who have $1,000 violins when it starts raining?
Yeah, nothing good.
Yeah, they have to leave. So they left. And so I'm there with the core band, and there's like 5 of us, and Charlie Bishrad, my good friend, who is an electric violin player, he said, come on, let's play. And the audience wouldn't leave. They kept stomping their feet because they had put on slickers. They knew Red Rocks, and they put up their umbrellas, and we knew this special was over and there wasn't anything to film anymore. So we just played for the audience and they went insane just knowing that we were sticking 7,000 people, you know, we'd given.
But that's the rawness. You went with the situation, you leaned into it, as they would say today. I think my favorite track from the Red Rocks original recording was 491. I learned about the greatness of appropriate percussivity from Yanni, you know, and it's just a phenomenal song. Was that before the rain?
That was after the rain. I don't write, never have really. I mean, I've written a few pop songs, right? I really like writing linear music. So a lot of those songs, they have all kinds of movements, but you may never even hear them again, even though I'm a big fan of John Williams, you know? And so, and writing sports music, a lot of those songs were just huge. I mean, and even before you got to the orchestra, they were huge. And then all of a sudden you got 7 trombones and 4 bass trombones all playing it and tubas, you know, and so it was big, and it was as big as the fireworks that were up on top of the stanchions.
I have a really terrible version of that that anecdote, because I was giving a piano concert to 2,000 nurses at an annual trade show in Philadelphia in 2004. And it was this massive ballroom in this massive hot hotel, and the piano was up on a podium, and there was spotlight. They did a really good job lighting it for a hotel. And I get up there on stage, and I had rehearsed and practiced beforehand. And I don't know what happened in the 20 minutes before and after, but I got on stage, I started playing, and the entire pedestal, the entire thing fell off the piano. It fell off the piano.
I've had that happen. Go ahead.
But you know what? I just kept playing. I did my 1 hour concert for them with no pedals. And that was it. And not everyone's a musician, you know, you kind of play for the crowds, but I just did it. You lean in, you do it. And that was one of the most human experiences I had, fumbling for air while trying to maintain, you know, just something really special. So,
Yeah, you should follow us around on tour. That stuff happens like every other show. You know, it's like the microphones fall into the piano, and you know, people fall off. We've had violin players fall off stages. But the wild thing, though, is, you know, that long story of playing in the rain is that 20-minute segment Every time it was played on PBS, it was that 20-minute segment was part of an hour and a half full show. Mm-hmm. That was a self-contained segment. And at the end of that segment, you know, they pledge, you know, for this you can get the album, for this you can get the DVD, and you can get tickets to the concert. And that segment, even to this day, it raises the most money because it's the most compelling. Right. You purchase the 80-piece Colorado Symphony Orchestra, and then it's four or five guys playing in the rain, and that's what gets people.
Yeah, that's where the meat and potato hits.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I want to get to your book again, Relentless: Unleashing a Life of Purpose, Grit, and Faith. You know, we do have the cancer story. You have I actually lost the use of my left hand for a year and a half, and I had to stop playing, which is why I did not get to formally study with Jerry Goldsmith at USC. You lost your voice and had to go through tremendous challenges to get that back. You know, the book called Relentless, one of my favorite words in the world is perseverance, and not because it has lots of syllables, but a lot of people have to self-define that, whether it is hearing no a million times and just keeping on figuring out that you want to get this done. I know we both love Seven Habits, the book. Where does this factor into you just got to keep going?
Yeah, it's hard to describe, isn't it? I mean, you and I are in a unique club. Not completely unique because other people who are listening are in that club. But when you face death, right? When that moment almost exactly 5 years ago when the doctor told Connie, and I patted Connie on the back and said, you know, hon, it's time to go make lemonade out of lemons. That, you know, I actually dealt with, everybody thinks that it was like, oh, John, you know, he battled through it and won the battle and I went through every possible iteration of you know, emotional disaster. You know, I mean, at first it was, okay, let's get smart about this. Let's read Patrick Walsh's book on surviving prostate cancer. Let's call up Patrick Walsh and let's find the best surgeon. Let's find the best. And you know, the job that we do every day is we interview experts. But then you know, your first thought, right, is get the cancer out, get it out, take my prostate out, take all the tumors out, you know, blah, 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 blah. And it doesn't occur to you what the collateral damage is going to be, you know. And so I had plenty of that where my body shut down, and they were shoving NG tubes up inside me. And you experience at whatever level it is, you experience an enormous amount of suffering. And it's not like, you know, I hate it when people say, somebody says, "Hey, I've got back pain. Oh, you should try this," you know, or it's probably you're that. You don't know, right? You know, and it's the same thing with chemo, where you know, it's everybody reacts differently to this stuff, and I did not react well to it. I wanted to kill myself, and I talked about killing myself. I talked about taking kettlebells, those Russian exercise things and weights, and strapping them to my ankles and jumping in the pool because I like the water. Once I read. When I could read and when I could listen, once I read Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning. Viktor Frankl, as you know, is a Holocaust survivor. And you read a book like that, and all of a sudden you feel like, you know, what you're going through is a head cold.
Little perspective,
and,
right?
Yeah, it is. And that's that thing you're talking about with Stephen Covey is recognize the paradigm. There's a chapter in the book called Pity Party, which I highly recommend because it shows what happens when you feel sorry for yourself and you don't pull yourself up by your bootstraps, because I almost lost my family. I was drinking. I was going through chemo. I was drinking heavily. I was taking Vicodin. I was a mess.
It can destroy you in a way that you don't have as a native behavior. I had the incredible blessing and fortune to meet in person Bernie Siegel, if you remember Bernie Siegel. who was one of the preeminent cancer surgeons of the 80s. And he had the gall, by today's standards, this will sound funny, he had the gall to talk about how your mind-body factors into how well you live through cancer and hopefully beyond cancer. And he wrote a book called Love, Medicine, and Miracles. Similar to you, I just called the guy up. Like, I called up this legend and I said, hey, I don't know how I got your phone number, but I want to meet you. I have cancer. I'm 23 years old. I just want to... And he invited me up to his house and I drove up there. We went through the book and he taught me this idea. Because back in those days, back in the 80s and the 90s, they didn't tell you anything more than just the biology. But this idea of your mental health, how do you connect with communities, with people, with peers to balance out the horrors of this uprooting everything in your life? And I've never really mentioned this on the air or in any media that I've done, but there was a moment in time in like March of 96 where I was just so sick and throwing up 20 times a day, racked in pain. I lost 110 pounds of body weight in 3 months. And I had my first suicidal thought, and thankfully my only suicidal thought in my entire life. So this is where I felt it was so critical to even 10 years later take an active role in making sure that that crap doesn't happen to the next person, and you're in that same place now.
Well, and I was 40 years older than you when I got that, when I got my diagnosis. And so I went a different way. I fought for a little bit, but then I became a cancer patient. And so what my subconscious mind did to me was, I'll step back and talk about how I think I got the cancer, but what it did to me was saying, well, you've done some good stuff. You've been a good dad, maybe a good grandpa. And let's find somebody to replace you, like my sons replaced me on the radio. And I just behaved like I had literally one foot in the grave. I mean, I sort of put myself into my own personal hospice, if you will. I was using different drugs to do it. But yeah, so I really had given up, and I became a cancer patient. But I became more of a cancer patient than I was even before I got diagnosed. And I'll explain that, because my dad got cancer and died at 63 years old. The same year in his life and in my life that I got cancer, diagnosed. And so I just want to live one day longer than my dad. And once I started studying, you know, three years after we'd been going through treatments for my cancer, I came upon something called divine healing, which is basically certain scriptures in the Bible that are the promise of healing that churches, a lot of churches do not teach. Some do, most don't. And the scripture that I landed on, my wife and I both at the same time, was one called Mark 11:23, which says, whoever says to this mountain, be removed and be cast into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will be done, will have what he says. Therefore, whatever you ask when you pray, believe that you receive it and you will have it. Now, that's Jesus not talking to just, you know, the apostles, the disciples, but talking to everybody beyond the 2,000 years ago that needed to hear it. And then there was also Proverbs 18:21, which is death and life are in the power of the tongue. And when I came upon, and listen, I had read all of this stuff when I was a kid. I grew up in the church. But until you understand what the authority is, what your authority is over sickness, and that when Christ went to the cross, he not only took our sins, because that's what people mostly preach, but also it's in there in the Bible, took our griefs, our sorrows, and our sicknesses, that God's nature is to want us well, not to put sickness on us. And I always thought that I had gotten the cancer because God wanted me to have a ministry, you know, and it's not in the Bible anywhere.
You know, I have a phenomenally dogmatic approach to how do you make sense of crap you can't possibly, you know, understand. And, you know, Bernie really gave me that perspective with this, you know, love and medicine are kind of tangible in a sense. And, you know, what is a miracle? I live and breathe by Mel Brooks, all-time favorite. And he used to do the skit in the 60s, maybe you remember it, with Carl Reiner called The 2,000-Year-Old Man.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And one of the bits where Carl asks him, he says, where does God come from? And in traditional Mel Brooks fashion, he says, oh, we used to worship Phil. And Carl's like, who the hell is Phil? He's like, oh, Phil was nice, but then Phil got struck by lightning, and we looked up and said, oh, there's something bigger than Phil. And like, that's... what a great way to just kind of summarize in Mel Brooks fashion what miracles really can be.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, You know, when I, my story is, and there's more detail in the book than I can do right now, but the supernatural thing that happened to my body when my mind, when my heart, when my spirit was finally done with treatment, they wanted to irradiate my pelvis with 67 treatments over 3 months, basically carpet bomb my pelvis because they found two lymph nodes that had lit up after my prostate was removed.
Is that the ADT story?
So androgen deprivation therapy also is when they take testosterone out of your body, which is equally as for some people, and it was for me, as nasty as the chemo, and they're doing it at the same time. But when they wanted to do the radiation, he went through the list of all of the contraindications, the functions that I might be losing in my pelvic area. They got to a couple of the functions that I was really fond of. and to be, not to be flip, but to be honest, faith was born. If you've seen the scene with Leonidas, the Spartan king in 300, looking back at his queen, and making the decision to kick the messenger down into the well instead of accepting subservience to Xerxes. That's exactly the look that Connie and I had. And at that moment, I was not only healed of cancer, I was healed of arthritis. And so we have been since then, and this was 2 years ago, we don't have a church in our area that we like. So instead we go to a subacute facility every Sunday. There's like 10 of us, and we lay hands on the sick and pray for the sick with the same procedure that got me healed of cancer.
Yeah, I mean, I have experienced meeting hundreds of thousands of people from the cancer space in the last 15 years, and it continually inspires me to see how everyone has their own way of defining how this happened to them, how they reconcile this with the universe. And, you know, it doesn't judge, it doesn't care, it just, it's there. And I was diagnosed 25 years ago. I think I mentioned that. And just to see, though, how far we've come, where 25 years ago, prostate cancer could have been a death sentence. And here you are, you know, even 5 years ago. And congrats on 5 years. That's like a nice little cancerversary milestone, by the way, is how the humanity of dealing with all the crap can really, the community is there. And it wasn't there for me. It wasn't there for millions of people, but it is there today. And the fact that you have been very open about this, wrote this book about this, it's going to help other people in a way that I probably could not have been helped 25 years ago.
Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, well, you know, 5 years before I had it's important to note that when I had my first surgery at Johns Hopkins from Dr. Ted Schaefer, amazing surgeon, but he was known for treating aggressive cancer aggressively. And he even used those words, so did Patrick Walsh, who trained him. And Patrick Walsh was one of the first guys to use the Da Vinci robotic laparoscopic prostatectomy and robots basically. And then Dr. Brian Chapin, another surgeon who did my second surgery, and then Christopher Logothetis, my oncologist. If I hadn't had faith for those guys and for all those hospitals, I'd be dead right now. And so it's really important to figure out what you have faith for. And it's a training thing. You know, I mean, my wife and we go to bed every night, and yeah, maybe we'll watch a comedy every now and then, but we listen to people like Curry Blake and Barry Bennett and Andrew Womack, all of them two of them out of Karis Bible College. This is a school that all they teach is healing. And the power of the Holy Spirit. You know, we're going to kill ourselves if we don't renew our minds, and that's in the book of Romans. Fear of COVID-19, fear of cancer, fear of lack, fear of losing your job. You will end up. I can tell you because I've done it. You will end up manifesting that. I manifested cancer in my life, absolutely no question. DNA is only 5% of what's going to happen to you. Epigenetics tells us that the rest of it, 95%, has to do with not only diet and fitness, but a big part of it is what you're talking about healing your mind. You can have all these thoughts. We have millions of thoughts every day, but the moment you take one and speak it out, it's a whole different ball game. And even Dr. Caroline Leaf, the neurosurgeon, will tell you that spoken words can affect your body at the subatomic level. So take that, right?
Well, you had me at epigenetics, by the way. My one of my favorite jargon geek words of all of oncology. I have one more fun like to go in a fun direction. I had the chance to have dinner with Jason Priestley many, many years ago. And I jokingly asked him how blunt of an object does it carry around when he meets people that just goes, da-na-na-na, da-na-na-na. You know,
right.
So I just have to ask you, how often do people just walk up to you and start singing the E.T. song?
Not as often as they used to, because people have really sort of grown out of it. You know, there's, but I have plenty of people who will sing the NBA basketball theme to me, because it has more of an emotional response for people who grew up with Magic and Michael Jordan and what's his name, the announcer.
Marv Albert?
Marv Albert, yeah. Yes! Yeah. And so I probably get that more often than I was doing an interview with my old friend Adam Carolla the other day, and we were talking about the old days when I used to just get made fun of all the time. I mean, it was, you know, every cartoon was, you know, a picture of hell, and it was me playing piano in hell, you know. and he asked me, he said, did that ever get, you know, but and when Red Rocks happened, it was sort of over for all that madness, because Newsweek did a big story calling it the Teshing of America, you know.
Wow.
That whole thing. Yeah, it was, but even after that, it wasn't like, see, told you, because I understand how it works. And I think the reason I understand and I understood how it works is that I was in the media business, you know, sitting on a preeminent entertainment news desk for 10 years, covering everybody and watching everybody go through and interviewing everybody. You know, you can see the people who don't take themselves too seriously, and you start to much prefer their attitude to the people who just don't want you to touch them with anything less than what they think of themselves.
Yeah, haters gonna hate. That's a just never ending. But you know, the fact that all that happened in the 80s before social media, definitely different dynamic with the public.
Yeah, I mean, Twitter's got to be of Satan, right? Just try to stay away from that thing. But it's, I didn't want to write a book. You know, I didn't think about writing a book. It's not that I didn't want to. I like reading books, but when HarperCollins came to me after hearing the story about the divine healing approach that Connie and I took to the end of my journey, they said, would you be interested in writing a book? And I said, I don't know, not just about cancer. And they said, well, make us an outline of your life. And you know, I'm not sure how much you journal, but I highly recommend it. And I really didn't until I decided to write this book. And it was supposed to be done in 6 months. And 2.5 years later, I finished it, which part of it was because I was still going through my journey, and I wanted to include all of that stuff. But when you go back and when you're forced, and I was, because I said yes to this book, when you're forced to go back and find a way to fill 80,000 words, and some of that's your life, I went back and I looked at when I was 19 and a half years old, I'm in a tent because I got thrown out of school for forging a professor's name to a drop ad card. And then my father, who was shamed by that, by my decision, he threw me out of the house, and I ended up in a park breaking concrete with a shovel in a construction crew. And then 3 years later, I'm anchoring the news in New York City at WCBS-TV at 23 years old, as the youngest correspondent in the history of CBS. And to my left is John Stossel. To my right is Meredith Vieira. In front of me is Bill O'Reilly and Brian Williams. And I look back at that and said, I thought that was 10 years. You know, I look back and it was 36 months. And that's when you understand that God is there and there's a Holy Spirit taking care of you. And so connecting the dots is really a great exercise, no matter how you do it, whether it's journaling or writing a book.
Yogi Berra, who's the Sherpa of life, of course, once said that, you know, if life were easy, everyone would do it. Going back to perseverance and pushing forward and finding a way to make sense of everything that works for you and inspiring other people out there, you know, it's Passover tonight, and it's all about, you know, with the plague passing over our houses out
there.
Yeah,
man.
And April being the month with the most religious holidays and the most spirituality around the world, you know, it's really appreciating everything that we have and how we're trying to, I say, make it suck a little less for everyone else by learning what we've gone through.
Yeah, but the other thing you have to remember, though, is since the fall, when the snake got involved with Adam and Eve, that was, you know, that everything changed then. That was a long time ago. But since that time, we have as human beings been faced with suffering. And I didn't always embrace suffering. And when I read Viktor Frankl's memoir, I started to understand it, listening to some Jordan Peterson stuff. But most profoundly, years ago, I read M. Scott Peck's book, The Road Less Traveled. And the first sentence is, life is difficult, period. And then new paragraph. And it's like, until you can understand that, get the revelation of it, and then work on transcending it, you'll never have a full life. And it's just so true. And until somebody does the tablecloth trick where they pull your life out and there's some stuff standing and some's not, and that's not talking about your cancer diagnosis, you don't really understand what suffering is. And I think if people could really, if there's some way you could get to where you and I are without having to go through what you went through, if you can get to that revelation, you save yourself so much pain. And then the other thing to realize, and you know this, and I'll leave you with this, is one of my all-time favorite quotes it came upon me after I wrote the book, so it's not in the book, but it's such a great quote, is from Thomas Edison. It is this: most people miss an opportunity because it's dressed in overalls and it looks like work. Anything you want to do, and that means whether you want your own Red Rock special, or you want to get out of a tent and get busy, or you want to meet the woman of your dreams, or you want to beat cancer, it's a lot of work. It's dressed in overalls and it's a lot of work, and sometimes it takes training.
John Tesh, thank you so much for an incredible interview. Your new book, Relentless, Unleashing a Life of Purpose, Grit, and Faith. The man, the myth, the legend, John Tesh. Thank you.
My pleasure.
That's all for today, folks. If you like today's show, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, follow us on social, and tell all your friends to listen. Out of Patience with Matthew Zachary is a product of Offscript Media. Our executive producer is Matthew Zachary. Our senior producers are Brianna Seely, Jen Orange, and Andrew McDowell. It is mixed and edited by Brianna Seely. Our theme music is by the Mike Van Allen Quintet and by Mara. For advertising and media inquiries, email media@offscript.com. Hit us up at contact@offscript.com to share comments, feedback, and make recommendations. For more information, visit offscript.com.